We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Yesterday in Chicago, a jury convicted former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich of corruption. He was found guilty on 17 of 20 counts, several of them calling for prison terms of up to 20 years, although the speculation now is that he may end up serving sometime between 10 and 15 years. Among the charges he faced were charges that he attempted to use the appointment of Barack Obama's replacement in the U.S. Senate to the attempt he wanted to turn that to his personal gain. The outcome of this trial, this was the second, very different from his first trial in August of last year when the jurors there deadlocked on 23 of 24 counts against him. He was convicted in that first trial of lying to investigators, and prosecutors decided to retry him. We'll talk this morning about the trial, about the outcome, about what that means for Illinois politics. And over the course of the hour, we have three guests that will be joining us. For the full hour here in the studio with me is Rick Winkle. He's director of the Office of Public Leadership at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at University of Illinois. He served as visiting fellow of IGPA and also adjunct professor in the College of Law. He's also served in the legislature. He was an Illinois state senator from 2003 until 2007, and then a state representative from 1995. Or before that, was a state representative from 1995 until 2003. And also joining us for the first half of the program by telephone is Dick Simpson. He heads the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois Chicago. He also has been involved in Chicago politics. He served on the Chicago City Council from 1971 to 1979 and also worked on the transition teams of Mayors Jane Byrne and Harold Washington. So here in studio, I say to Rick Winkle, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thanks.
Good to have you with us. And joining us on the phone, Dick Simpson. Professor Simpson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'd just like to give you each the opportunity to talk and give whatever sort of general reaction you have. Maybe I'll start with Professor Simpson, a general reaction to the outcome of the second trial.
Well, unfortunately, it secures again our position as the most corrupt state in the nation, and in the case of Chicago, the most corrupt city. We do have competitors in places like New Jersey and Louisiana and Miami, but unfortunately, we lead in the corruption sweepstakes. There's been about 1,500 public officials convicted since 1970. Our best estimate is it's costing taxpayers about $500 million a year in bad contracts, patronage, and other forms of corruption. And it occurs at all level, at the state level, as in Governor Blagojevich, in the suburbs around Chicago, downstate, and in Chicago itself.
Mm. Rick?
Well, once again, we see that the federal prosecutor has to step in and kind of bludgeon us back into the path here. We've relied way too long in Illinois on federal prosecutions to kind of remedy this culture of corruption that's permeated our political culture for so long. And it's been a long time. I mean, you go back, Len Small in the 20s, we read about that in the Chicago Tribune just about a week or so ago. But, of course, that's a part of our history. It's very real. It's business as usual. We've tolerated political corruption for way too long at many different levels. And Professor Simpson is exactly correct. I mean, we've relied on these federal prosecutions over the past 30 years. You know, just looking back through the mid-90s to the present, it's over 400 state and local officials been successfully prosecuted in the Northern District of Illinois. People have to realize that this is a problem, and it's a problem that does make us somewhat unique.
Mm. Well, as maybe here again, I'll turn back to Professor Simpson. As the story has moved along, there's been an almost constant sidebar reminding us just how much political corruption there is in Illinois. You know, for example, of the 20 men who have been elected governor of the state of Illinois, six have been accused of serious crimes, four convicted or pleaded guilty, two acquitted. So that's just looking at the office of the governor, that's significant. Illinois is not the only place with political corruption. But one comes back to this question, why? Do you think that there is something about Illinois that makes it such a fertile ground for corruption?
Well, we have a politics of corruption, as Rick mentioned. It goes back for more than 100 years. The first public corruption case was 1869, when members of the Chicago City Council and the Cook County Board of Commissioners gave a phony contract for painting City County Hall. That's a very long period, and it's always tied to machine politics. And that across both parties, there have been Democrats and Republicans who've been part of that machine politics system, in which jobs are traded for precinct work and favors are traded for votes and contracts are traded for campaign contributions. That system, which has been endemic in Illinois all this time, is characterized not only by the Democrats in the city of Chicago, but say the Republicans in DuPage County. It is a system that has to be changed. We recommended, much like the governor's commission on ethics, about 25 different steps that would have to be taken to eliminate corruption.
You want to mention one or two things specific?
Well, the one or two things are most obvious, of course, is something like electing consistently public officials who not only say they're for reform, but actually implement changes and make it clear to public employees that any form of corruption or patronage or waste will not be tolerated. There have been some steps in that direction since the first arrest of Blagojevich. But some of the broader ones include changing the public school curriculum to allow not only civics to be taught, which it no longer is in Chicago, but to allow specifics about corruption and the cost of corruption. In 1909, when we adopted the Burnham Plan in Chicago, it didn't get implemented right away. That was the plan to beautify the city, protect the lakefront, and so forth. It took the Wacker Manual, which was taught to eighth graders, for 20 years before there were enough civic leaders and enough public support for the bond referendums to remake Chicago into the more beautiful city it is today.
I mentioned, the Professor Simpson here mentioned the fact that after the governor was charged, there was that energized a movement for reform that had been there before. And I think that people had made the argument that one of the best things that we could do to try to eliminate corruption would be to place some limits on campaign contributions in Illinois, where there are none. Now, there have been some changes, but I think people have argued that they just don't go far enough. Rick, can you talk a little bit about what has happened and what you think should happen past that?
Well, it really is intimately intertwined in this Blagojevich saga. As this unfolded after he was arrested, yes, there was a major push then to implement ethics and campaign finance reform that went into place. And you're right, in Illinois, there have been no limits. People are fond of saying it's been the wild, wild west of campaign finance. Wide open, no limits. Anybody can contribute without any dollar limitation, and that did change, and so that did come out of this arrest of Blagojevich when he was trying to trade or sell the Senate seat. Mm-hmm. So that's a positive thing. But of course, what happened then is Blagojevich, we can tell it was going to be somewhat effective. He raced against the clock to try to raise funds as quickly as he could, and started leaning on potential contributors to make their contributions at a higher limit than what the new laws would have permitted. Mm-hmm. So we know that, I think, from that little experiment or a little bit of a story there, that it probably can have an impact. It can be positive. But I like what Professor Simpson has focused on here. It's not so much new ethics laws or that we're going to, add more rules about campaign finance. While I do believe disclosure and these kinds of laws on limitations do have a place, and should be considered and may be a part of a solution. The comprehensive, meaningful, sustained change in the political culture really can't depend on the federal prosecutors or the draftsmanship and passage of new laws require the obvious. Don't bribe, don't extort, that's kind of thing. Don't abuse your power. What it really takes is the public, you know, not only the public officials and the political parties, but the public in general needs to pay attention, needs to inform itself, needs to participate, needs to be at the polls, needs to communicate with the public officials and the political parties, and they have to be a part of the solution, actively a part of the solution. This has been a long-term problem in the state of Illinois. We can't turn it on a dime. People can't just throw up their arms in despair. I suppose you could move to another state, but rather than do all that, let's fix, and we can fix, the problem in Illinois. But it's going to take the people paying attention and becoming very involved and insisting that the parties and public officials be responsive and not engage in this kind of behavior that's been winked at and said, oh, well, that's just the way it's done in Illinois. That's got to stop.
Yeah. I think, Professor Simpson, you have said the same thing. Rick is certainly in agreement. The Chicago Tribune had what I thought was one of the most strongly worded editorials I think I've ever read in that paper, saying to the people of Illinois, don't just shrug this off. Don't say, well, okay, I'm glad that's over. Now we can get on with life. Don't be accepting of the idea that that's just the way Illinois politics is. Now, having said all that, though, I wonder how you achieve that kind of change. I mean, how do you get – people are busy. They got all kinds of things on their mind. And it's not as if the news media is not paying attention. So the question is, how do you get voters to pay attention?
Well, I think the first step is to agree on a common agenda. The one that the Ethics Committee proposed is a good one. A simplified version is in Pat Collins' book on corruption in Illinois. We have some on my website, which is a Chicago Politics website, which are very similar to the ones that the Ethics Commission proposed. All of this, so if we can agree on an agenda and say, yes, we'll do these 20 steps, then we just systematically have to do them. And it does begin with electing public officials who are committed to ethics and will enforce it in their own domain. And it proceeds from there to many different steps. But mostly it's a change of attitude. We've seen that actually in Chicago. It used to be that if you were caught on, say, Lakeshore Drive in Chicago speeding, you would just wrap a $10 or $20 bill around your driver's license, hand it to the policeman, and go on your way. No one would think about bribing a policeman anymore because they're more likely to end up in jail. And that's actually changed in the last decade. So changes are possible, but it does require both leadership from the public officials, both elected and appointed, and it takes what Rick was calling for, a public that cares, and cares beyond the one immediate event. After every major conviction, say after George Ryan's conviction, Blagojevich, in fact, ran on a platform saying he would bring reform. He just didn't keep his word. We will have a flurry of small-scale reforms, but it's going to take, I think, 20 years of sustained effort, both by the public forces and public interest groups. I'm encouraged, for instance, that the BGA, which was almost out of business, a Better Government Association is housed in Chicago, has raised more than $2 million to fight corruption and has become alive again. I think there is a receptive public that's willing to respond if they're given the opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's definitely true. And, the question really is, can the law be used in a way, can public policy be used to transform culture? And I think we've got some really good examples of that. As you look back in the early 60s, you had the drive to eliminate smoking. I mean, that's still in the news. It's still not over with. It's still being discussed and debated and argued about. Being a moderate to conservative Republican, I'm not much for social engineering. But, you know, there is a place, and this is one of them, where, you know, you do look at trying to transform culture. And smoking is an example. The Civil Rights Act and its implementation over the years, and its enforcement has changed attitudes and the way we behave in society, the way we treat each other. Has it changed everything perfectly? No, it's still an ongoing process, but it has been transformative. Another example is drunk driving. I mean, just as the Lakeshore Drive example Professor Simpson just gave, I mean, we used to laugh and wink and nod about drinking and driving. It was a joke, and it's certainly not funny anymore because we realize for what it really is, it has real-life consequences. We have to come to grips that political corruption has real-life consequences, and it can be changed, and we have to be a part of the solution.
Right. Let me introduce again our guest here in studio with me, Rick Winkle. He's director of the Office of Public Leadership at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at University of Illinois, and joining us by telephone from Chicago, Dick Simpson. He heads the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois, Chicago. And we're talking about some of the implications of the conviction. Just happened yesterday of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. He was convicted of corruption. Questions, by the way, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have a question for Professor Simpson, since you follow Chicago politics. I was really struck by something in a column that I read this morning in the Tribune by John Cass, where he made reference to the falling out between the former governor and his father-in-law.
Yes.
Dick Mell, and how that helped to, and how charges that Mr. Mell made of pay for play on his son-in-law's part helped to get the feds interested in the governor, which makes one wonder just, and maybe you can give us a little bit more background on this, to what extent that family spat might have actually ultimately contributed to the former governor being convicted.
Well, first of all, Dick Mell is an alderman and ward committeeman, very powerful in the city of Chicago on the northwest side in a white ethnic, now Latino, area of the city. He's been a ward boss for quite a number of years. He was in the city council when I was, back in the 1970s. Dick Mell's political organization drafted, or in fact, Dick Mell personally drafted Blagojevich to run for state legislature, then manipulated the situation for his congressional campaign, started up his gubernatorial campaign when that happened. They had a falling out because one of their family members owned a place where you could deposit the garbage, the waste from the city of Chicago, and they wanted to not have the state inspectors look too closely at it and place limits on it. And at a Thanksgiving dinner, they had a family argument. Blagojevich refused in that case to go along with the idea of supporting the other family member, a distant relative. And that fight that escalated, really it was also about Mel thought he should be running much more of the government because he had made Blagojevich, and Blagojevich wanted to run the government his own way. And they parted ways. Mel said some very strong accusations against Blagojevich, leaked them to the press or responded to the press, and that set a feud going that caused what was already federal investigations of some deals in the Blagojevich administration, put the federal government on a much faster course to trace it. It took quite a few years, another term of the governor, before it actually ended up in his eventual indictment and arrest. But it was one of the things that sped the process.
Hmm. Let us talk with a caller here, someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if you have any observations on the impeachment of Blagojevich. It seems to me when the vote was taken of the legislators, it was by an oral voice vote, and that seemed very unfair because the first 10 or 15 legislators, if they vote for impeachment, and the others are intimidated, and it's a snowball effect, and it's not a true validation of the sentiment of the legislators, in my opinion.
Well, maybe Rick would have a thought about them.
I didn't detect that in the least bit. My impression, my recollection, it was there was one present vote in the House out of the 118 members who voted. It was overwhelming for impeachment. And the trial itself was 59-0. I mean, it was overwhelming for conviction. So I'm not quite sure I follow what the caller is getting at. I don't see anything that influenced the outcome of that vote. I think it was very clear from the evidence that there was an abuse of power that was systematic through the administration. And I think the prosecutors in the House amply demonstrated that during the trial. The Senate was persuaded enough to unanimously convict.
Mm. It certainly didn't seem at that point that the former governor had many friends or supporters left in Springfield.
And quite frankly, the governor decided really not to put on any sort of defense. And as it turns out, even when he does testify, it probably doesn't help that much.
No. All right. I don't know. Professor Simpson, anything you would want to add to that?
No, I think everyone knows how the legislators voted, and they were unanimous or near unanimous. One of Mel's other daughters was the one to not vote against Blagojevich, but otherwise it was a unanimous decision, and the legislators clearly had the evidence before them, both in the impeachment and in the trial in the Senate. Hmm.
And frankly, he was actually impeached by two different houses. I mean, the one General Assembly was just ending and voted for impeachment. So he was impeached twice.
They just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
When the new group came in, they went through the process again.
They did.
Yeah. The big differences between the two trials was that in the second trial, Mr. Blagojevich testified. He spent 7 days on the stand. In the first trial, he didn't, in spite of the fact that early on, I think he said he was looking forward to the opportunity to make his case. So, and I was really struck by some of the comments from the jury saying that they actually found him likable, but they managed to set that aside as they were looking at the evidence. And I'm just interested maybe in what both of you might think, and I'll start with Rick, about whether or not it made a big difference here in the second outcome that his attorneys put him on the stand.
Well, I'm not an expert at criminal defense trials or criminal prosecutions, but I got the impression from the first time the defense was able to put on pretty much everything it wanted to in the first trial through cross-examination. And in the second trial, the judge did not allow that, and objections were sustained and really kind of forcing their hand and then deciding really to mount a defense, which was putting Blagojevich on the stand. Look, I mean, I got to tell you, when I say the public has a responsibility here, I'm not saying that I read Blagojevich perfectly myself. I knew him as a state representative. I served with him in 95 and 96. When he was elected governor, I was just newly elected to the state Senate. One of the first things I did was to break with my caucus to try to help the governor, the newly elected governor, Rod Blagojevich, with the pension bond proposal, because I didn't think the bad fiscal situation was of his making. Eventually, I and three other Senate Republicans voted with the Democrats to pass this. I say this not as a brag, but I was taken in by Rod Blagojevich myself, and he is a very charismatic, charming fellow. That he's likable. I simply did not. Perhaps it was naivete. I did not realize that he was a crook, and. Obviously, we discovered that within the year, and became very evident that there was this systematic trading for employment and contracts and shaking down contributors and building up a big war chest. We figured it out. But I'm not certainly in judgment against the public for having been taken in, although I will say, when he was elected the second time, he was elected notwithstanding the fact that Tony Rezko had been indicted a month earlier, which just absolutely stunned me. And it's very unique for a prosecution or prosecutor to have that kind of high profile indictment come out just days, you know, a month before, you know, because they don't want to influence that. But it was that serious, and the comments that Patrick Fitzgerald made concerning endemic employment scandals throughout the administration. He wanted to send a clear message, and apparently we weren't paying attention.
Well, I want to come back to Professor Simpson. This is something that I think people who follow Illinois politics keep coming back to again and again. And they said that they could see how Blagojevich might have been elected the first time on the strength of his promise to clean up Springfield. But how, given that, as Rick just said, we already knew about Tony Rezko, how is it that he got reelected?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that Blagojevich did some things that were important to constituencies. For senior citizens, for instance, they got free rides on the CTA. For parents in the lower incomes, their children got medical attention and an expansion of the state programs for Medicaid. And there were other things like that. And it partly just it wasn't the opponent, Judy Topinka, who was a good, solid candidate, would have made a good governor, just wasn't able to get her point across. Part of it was the money. Blagojevich, if I remember right, had $20 million or in that vicinity in that second campaign, and his ads and the rest of it just overwhelmed what was a very low Republican budget. Mm.
And we now know, of course, how he was able to raise such record-breaking amounts of campaign contributions over the years. I mean, that he was shaking down contributors. It was pretty clear from this trial that's what he was doing. The other thing, too, with Judy Topinka, she was damaged by, you know, her friendship with George Ryan. And, you know, this governor, who now is going to prison, Rod Blagojevich, former governor, used that to great effect in his campaign ads. Hmm.
There was the ad of her waltzing with Ryan that played over and over again.
What is that? So now going forward, what does that mean? Does this particularly give an advantage to candidates who could come along and say, I don't have any ties to anybody? I haven't been involved in state government or Springfield politics, so I can't. No one's got any hold on me.
No, you still have to raise more than $10 million to run effectively for governor in the state of Illinois.
So it's still all about the money.
Not all about the money. You also have to have some sort of public track record. Yes, there are plenty of businessmen running around loose who might want to run for governor or the rest, but if they haven't served in any public office and have never done anything related to government, they're simply not going to be a credible candidate to the voters in the end. There are always exceptions that we could name, like Bloomberg or Schwarzenegger or whoever. But in general, the public is going to look for someone with a public record, and the candidate is going to have to get their message to the voters, and that is expensive.
Another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering, I'm glad one of your guests raised all the things that Blagojevich did for constituents. Not that that excuses him, but I think that does explain a lot about how he was able to stay in office. But also, I think another thing I haven't heard mentioned much is his no new taxes pledge, which I think made him very popular with a lot of people, something that we hear a lot from Republican candidates still today, nationally and locally. People that seems to win over a lot of people without looking what that does to state finances in terms of bankrupting both the country and the state. I think the guest mentioned Tony Rezko was indicted, but you've got to remember indicted doesn't mean found guilty. At that point, a person is innocent until proven guilty, so it's very easy for people, especially when someone has just been announced they're indicted. That just means they've been charged with a crime, which it's very easy for people to, I mean, and it should be there to consider that person not found guilty yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Well, it's certainly a good standard for juries. I think that's certainly what we want in the courtroom. But I think we have to use critical thinking, good common sense. Use good judgment as voters and the electorate when we have a prosecutor with a proven track record of sending public officials who are corrupt to prison, and he makes a special point to send us a message. I think it's worth listening to and considering and weighing that there may be a problem here that we may want to weigh as we cast our informed vote. I think we, as voters, we have to be critical in our thinking towards candidates. I think we need to be more demanding and not just simply look at the surface of things. Oh gosh, good looking guy, good looking gal, or smooth talker, or whatever. And I don't mean to be insulting, but I think that we have to look deeper. And I think too many people don't, and we don't spend the time. We're all very busy. I understand that, but that's an excuse that favors machine type politics and corruption as usual.
We are at the point here we're going to take a very quick break, and we have to say goodbye to Professor Simpson. Any last sort of thought that you might like to leave with people who are listening?
Well, I think Rick was right on the point that both liberals and conservatives can agree that we do have to permanently fix the politics and culture of corruption that has been around in this state for over 100 years. At $500 million a year in taxpayer money and undercutting the faith and credit of public officials so that people may really raise a question about paying their taxes if they think it's all corrupt and a fixed deal. It is time for a change, and I think across political lines, that's something we can agree on. Hopefully we can agree on a common agenda and move it forward in the decade ahead.
Well, thanks very much for spending some time with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dick Simpson, he heads the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois, Chicago. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why so many tomatoes, especially in the winter, are tasteless. They're bred for hardness to withstand trucking, picked when still firm and green, and artificially gassed with ethylene until they turn red. We talk with Barry Estabrook, author of Tomato Land. He won a James Beard Award this year for his blog, Politics of the Plate. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We have 10 different topics throughout the week. Let me mention a couple. Tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the recent Walmart decision, that is the decision of the Supreme Court involving Walmart. And we'll talk with Leslie Wexler, who is professor of law here at the University of Illinois. On Thursday, we'll talk about changes that are just about to go into effect dealing with workers' compensation in the state of Illinois. And there we'll have two guests, Bob Bruno, who teaches in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at U of I, and also David Menchetti, who is an attorney. And then one more, we'll try to just do a general kind of roundup, talk about all of the things, and there certainly was a lot to talk about involved in the last session of the Illinois legislature. This will be on Thursday at 11 o'clock. Celeste Quinn, the host, and her guest will be Ray Long, State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and Robert Rich. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at University of Illinois. You can find out what we're doing by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs there. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of the program, we're talking about the outcome of the second trial, the second corruption trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Yesterday, a jury in Chicago convicted him of corruption. He was found guilty on 17 of 20 counts, including charges that he sought to gain personally in exchange for appointing Barack Obama's replacement in the U.S. Senate. And we're talking here this morning with Rick Winkle. He's director of the Office of Public Leadership at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the U of I, also served in both the Illinois State Senate and the House. And now joining us by telephone is Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at University of Illinois Springfield. He's someone who has, for a long time now, written about and followed the financing of political campaigns and also political ethics. He's joining us now by telephone. Kent Redfield, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Certainly.
What I did right at the beginning was just to give Rick and Dick Simpson a chance just to make a general comment or two about the outcome of this now second trial, and I want to give you the opportunity to do that.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, not a surprise. I mean, I think I would have been surprised if it would have gone the other way. I think it was a much tighter case. The governor may have helped himself a little bit by testifying in some instances, but overall, I think that probably was not a plus. Where we go from here is always one of those questions. If we just assume that it's bad luck or bad apple, then I don't know that we get to kind of the systemic things that we need to do to turn the system around, both in terms of ethical behavior, but also in terms of legitimacy and trust on the part of citizens. So this is the end of the Blagojevich era, but whether what kind of long term impact that has, we shall see.
Well, that is the big question. It seemed, reading some of the comments of the people who served on the jury, they seemed to be saying that they wanted to send a strong message, that this behavior with which the governor, former governor, was charged is not going to be tolerated. And they said that they thought that they indeed had sent that message. The question is, though, really, will anything change?
Well, I think that there are two elements to that. One is hardening the target, making it more difficult to be corrupt. It's fine if people, restrain themselves and don't do things because they're afraid they're going to get caught. But you also want people to act in ethical ways, not because they might get caught, but because they believe it's the right thing to do. And you want citizens to hold public officials accountable, not just to the the letter of the criminal law, but in terms of some standards involving ethics and public service.
Well, I think that this jury once again. I mean, this jury really did a terrific job. They caller earlier was saying that, innocent until proven guilty. They took that very seriously. I think they sifted through the evidence. They weighed it. They debated it, deliberated as they should have. And they sent, I totally agree, a very strong message that business as usual will not be tolerated. In fact, every jury that we've seen in these high-profile cases like the George Ryan or the Scott Fawell case, with the exception of the first trial for Rod Blagojevich, I mean, that seems to be the clear message. You can put on the defense that, hey, it's always been done this way. We're not doing anything differently than what's been done in the past. That doesn't fly. Juries reject that. You go to prison. With the exception, again, of course, but with that jury, with the one exception, there was a lone holdout. The majority of that jury panel would have convicted on several counts. I mean, that's a fact too. So, I guess the point is that yes, when you put 12 citizens in the room, you show them the evidence of this corruption. They do not buy that defense that it's always been done this way. They know better. They're not going to tolerate it, and that's the message they want to send. That's what the federal prosecutors have been doing for years for us, too, sending that message. Now, you can send all kinds of messages, but it's got to be received and understood and carried through. And who does that? Public officials, the parties themselves, but also the people. We as a people have to be receptive to this and insist that this change. And that's going to take quite a long time.
We have some callers here who've been patient, and we'll go back to the phones here, talk with someone in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. The discussion about the second Gbojevich election made me remember that, just waltzing with Ryan wasn't the only thing that one could shake at Topeka, and that was this hotel deal that was pretty scandalous that I remember at the time. So if you're choosing between two corrupt politicians, you might go with someone that's has done something or has been in the party that's done something for a wider constituency. But this whole bipartisan corruption is—it's not even just sequential bipartisan corruption. When I think about Blagojevich, and I've called about this a couple of other times, that Rezko is accused of being complicit with William Cellini, who was had been in the Edgar administration, and I don't know if he was involved in management services scandal or whether he was named as someone tangentially related to that or not. That goes back even further. But, he was involved. He's accused of being involved in shaking down a Hollywood producer for money to get some of this subsidy money for filmmaking. He was chair of the Republican Party of Sangamon County, if my memory serves, at the same time, if not the same time, sort of, you have been. So we have this cultural shakedown that it's participated in by both members of both parties at the same time. And I think he tried to sever his case from Rezko, but I don't think it was successful, and I really haven't followed it to know whether it's been adjudicated or not. But
I'm glad you raised the question, and that's something I wanted to ask both Kanda and Rick about, because they've been around Springfield politics, and that is, here we now have not heard the name of William Cellini for a while, his case was severed, and he's now, I believe, scheduled to go on trial in the early part of October. And maybe just for the background of people, who is Bill Cellini? And Kent, can you give us the basics?
Sure. No, I mean, you know, he was at one time he was the head of the Department of Transportation. He's been a longtime Republican power broker. Has made a tremendous amount of money because he got in on the ground floor on some of the gambling expansion in the 90s. Has represented the cement. The road builders, the asphalt association. I'm sorry, as a lobbyist, and so he's been a longtime Republican power broker. And the accusations involved manipulating who was selling and involved with investments on various state boards, and whether there were schemes to try and steer business and get kickbacks and those sorts of things. And that's, you know, Resgo was accused of being part of that, and along with Cellini, and Stuart Levin was the person who has been convicted and went to prison, and so that's, you know, there are going to be some legal, you know, there'll be residue from this, or we're not done with all of the different aspects of what the prosecutors are alleging was a pretty broad pattern of corruption in state government under Governor Blagojevich.
Hmm. Anything you would want to add there?
No, that's pretty accurate. The caller mentioned the Edgar administration. I'm not aware of any connection there at all. I mean, in the current charges or anything like that. I mean, that has nothing to do with that administration. The Levine and Resgo and Cellini indictment, as I understand it, has more to do with the Blagojevich administration. Yeah. You know, as you look back in the last eight governors, it is truly bipartisan. There's no question about it. The caller's right about that. Otto Kerner, Dan Walker, Rod Blagojevich are Democrats. George Ryan was a Republican. There's Republicans and Democrats. And certainly there should not be a concern here which party it's from. I think the bigger concern is that it exists. It exists through all levels of government in Illinois, as local and state. We've had Dick Simpson earlier said we had since the 1970s, we've had 1,500 successful convictions of public officials in Illinois. And yes, both parties. But I think, you know, for this to devolve into whether the Democrats are bad or the Republicans are bad, I think it kind of misses the point. The bigger problem is that we have a cultural acceptance or tolerance of way too much corruption. Can we have it perfect with no corruption at all? No, but we can certainly move in that direction, and we need to rapidly.
And we need to avoid the idea that this is somehow regional, that this is Chicago politics, which is something that you sometimes hear. But, George Ryan is a product of the Kankakee County political machine, and Kankakee County is a long way from the Chicago loop. So, it isn't regional. I agree with Rick. It is really cultural. It's about what are the standards? What are the expectations, both among voters and politicians?
All right, let's talk with someone else. Piatone, how about Charleston here, line number one? Hello.
Hi,
yes.
Calling from Charleston. Hi. I just wanted to make two observations. When I moved to Illinois many years ago, I was really struck by how the culture in the state just kind of winks and nods at political corruption. It's almost like the Cubs fans who take a kind of perverse pride in not having won the World Series for however long it's been, 100 and something years. You know what I mean? It's like they're almost proud of the fact that their politicians are as corrupt as they are. And then the second observation I'd make is where was the press in 2003, 2004, 2005? When Blagojevich was doing what he did?
Well, both good questions. Actually, some of my colleagues and I have been talking quite a lot about trying to think about the second question.
Yeah.
I'll turn to Kent, because I think it was also something we talked about in the first hour, how it is that we seem to have gotten this point where when you talk about political corruption in the state of Illinois, people just kind of shrug their shoulders and just say, well, that's Illinois. That's just the way it is. I don't know about taking perverse pride in it, but I think that people are kind of fatalistic about it. They just say, well, that's the way it is.
Yeah, and I said there is a lot of that. And that cynicism, you know, means that people don't accept government as legitimate. They don't participate. You don't get good people to get involved with state government. You know, that's something that, you know, Rick works on, you know, all the time is how do you, you know, improve the quality of the people that come in and you know, that want to, you know, that interstate government, public office, and how do you instill a sense of ethics? And ultimately the citizens suffer because you just don't get the quality of services and the efficiency and the effectiveness that that you should. And you know, we have done things with procurement. We've done things with campaign finance laws. We've done things with freedom of information. You know, there certainly are more that can be done. But when you have a situation where, you know, a state senator sponsors a bill that is that his father is lobbying for the company that benefits from the bill, you know, people, you know, which was an incident that led to an altercation on the Senate floor this spring. You know, when people just kind of accept those kind of blatant conflicts of interest, you know, you've it's hearts and minds as well as changing the law.
Mm. To the other point, I'll invite here Rick to start, but I'm certainly interested in what Kent thinks too. The state media, they cover the legislature. We had a good newspaper in Springfield. We got a big newspaper in Chicago. Your colleagues at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs are constantly turning out reports and white papers on issues of state government. We have no shortage of coverage of state government, but do you think that there's some way in which it's not doing the job?
Well, you know, excuse me, the coverage in Springfield has suffered a little bit with the decline of the newspapers. I mean, and the media in general. We don't have quite as many of the reporters. The Springfield press is shrinking. It has shrunk over the years, and I think that may be a part of it. Of course, this kind of activity is done secretly behind closed doors. It's very difficult to detect. I mean, how would people know why somebody's giving a $25,000 check for a contribution? Is it because they really believe in this person will be the next best governor that we've had and really going to change things and believes in good government? And, you know, or is it that that person is getting a job or a contract? These things need to. It's very difficult to sift through the evidence. Somebody's got to do it. The media really has a huge responsibility to do that job, to go through, to detect, connect the dots, and then to report. And, of course, the public then has a large role here in being receptive and understanding what's being reported and doing something about it. I mean, if you're angry about the way government's acting or behaving or the way your elected officials are behaving, don't just stop going to the polls and stop voting and dropping out of the process, because the lack of participation, it's not just some kind of civics mantra that, hey, get out to vote, you know, go vote because it's your civic responsibility. It has real implications with low turnout and low votes. Machine politicians can manipulate the outcome. They turn out their vote, and they just need enough in a low turnout election to win, 50% plus one. When people give up and don't participate and keep up on the issues and get out the vote, they let people manipulate the outcome of elections. And I think that's something that people have to realize, participate, and vote.
We're very short on time here. I want to try to get maybe one more caller here. We'll go to Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I know Mr. Winkle, and I want to thank him for his public service because he modeled some really good behavior of ethics while he was in office. As a matter of fact, I ran for public office in Urbana a couple times, and Rick taught me a valuable lesson, which was when you run for office and you win, you speak for all the people, not just your Republican or Democrat supporters. I thought that was a really important lesson that he taught me, as well as he did a great job with scholarships that were given out from the state. He had a totally neutral committee that once we reviewed applications, you knew that the kids who got scholarships from our district were reviewed by people who had no vested interest. The question I have, and this goes back to Governor Thompson, I believe that Mr. Salini was the one who built the Renaissance Hotel in downtown Springfield and was given a contract that he didn't have to pay back the money to the state unless he made a profit. And so for years and years and years, the hotel never showed a profit, so it never was required to pay any money back to the state. But I believe it was under Thompson that that deal was made. And I'll get off the line and listen. But I want to thank Rick for his hard work as state senator and state rep in terms of being honest and setting a great example for how politicians should be.
All right. Well, and I don't know if you want to say anything more about Salini, Bill Salini?
I think the caller is correct. There was something that involved both two different hotels and a former state treasurer who was also on the Democratic side. So there were, you know, there were all those issues about those arrangements, and eventually we got out from under them. But, you know, it is, you know, it's the sort of thing that we have to avoid, that it has to be a disadvantage rather than an advantage, that you know a politician or you gave them money or that you're the politician's friend. And that's a, you know, that's a very high standard. But if we're going to regain the confidence of the citizens, then, you know, we have to at least have that discussion.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this for a long time to come. And any we'll give you a chance for a last thought. Any last thing you'd like to add, Kent?
No, I've monopolized here a little bit, so I'd rather listen.
Well,
to
this Rick. Just your last comments were, I think that was a nice sort of closing thought. We'll do the same here with Ray.
Well, it does all go to legitimacy. I mean, we have to respect the process and the structure of our government, and we have to have people that we can trust that actually carry through and don't abuse power. And that's the message we got out of the Blagojevich trial, that you know, when you abuse your power, you're stripped of that power and you go to prison. We need more people that understand the responsibility to build up this respect and trust that's so lacking now in state government.
Yeah. Well, we will say thanks to our guest here, Kent Redfield. He's professor of political science at University of Illinois Springfield. Kent, once again, thanks very much for being with us.
Certainly. Happy to do it.
And in studio here with us, Rick Winkle. He's director of the Office of Public Leadership at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.